This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of January 12th, 2006.
All right, police!
Bad cop.
No donut.
Bad.
Cop.
No. Donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. This week, we will take an entire program to look at the use of tasers in law enforcement. Tasers are devices which incapacitate a person by shocking them with 50,000 volts of electricity. The shock is delivered either directly from contact with the weapon or through two small harpoon-like darts which resemble straightened fish hooks, which are attached to the weapon by two wires with a range of over 20 feet. Some critics equate the weapons with torture devices. The number of people who have died after being shocked with a taser is now rapidly approaching 200. Misuse of tasers by law enforcement personnel has been well documented on this program and elsewhere in the media. Tasers have come under increasing scrutiny from a number of sources: Amnesty International, the ACLU, the U.S. Justice Department, law enforcement agencies and personnel, activists, scientists, doctors, and others have called the safety of the weapons into question. Taser International continues to claim that their weapons are safe. Meanwhile, their company's stock prices and profits have dwindled under pressure from an alarming number of lawsuits from people who say that the company is responsible for wrongful death, misuse of the weapons, inadequate training materials, and a number of other legal responsibilities. On this program, we will learn about tasers through interviews with a journalist, a scientist, and a family member of a person who died after being shocked with a taser. We are going to start with an interview with Anne-Marie Cusick, an investigative reporter for The Progressive magazine. We spoke to her last spring after she wrote an article called The Trouble with Tasers.
I first started looking into stun guns, which I actually tend to separate from tasers, in around 1997. And at that point, Taser International did not have this kind of far-reaching market. In fact, it was just kind of a startup company, and early on it was called Air Taser. And there were a lot of different tasers at that point, and but what happened was in this Air Taser it introduced in 1994. In 1998, the company started something else, which it called Project Stealth. And it began to develop something, a taser with higher power. By higher power, I mean higher wattage. And the early tasers had about 5 watts of power. And Air Taser, I believe, had about 7 watts. But they started to really up the amount of wattage in a taser. And the reason that they wanted to do this was to bring about something called electromuscular disruption. I talked to a doctor who said that there's a certain point at about 14 watts where you get this electromuscular disruption, which means that the muscles in the body start to constrict, and the person is unable to resist and so falls on the ground. Part of the point for Taser International, according to its advertising material, in doing this was to get around the problems that tasers were. I mean, if you talk to police officers in the earlier part, the mid-90s, they would say, well, the taser doesn't always work. You know, if someone is mentally ill or on drugs or sometimes even on alcohol or just has strong willpower, they can withstand the taser and come at you anyway. And so there was a lot of, I guess I would call skepticism about these weapons. And what Taser did was, by upping the wattage, they got around that problem. At least that's what they claim.
So the new wattage is 26, right. I believe, is the level, and that was the, I guess that's the reason for the model names of the new, I think they're X26 and M26 tasers.
Right.
Are they?
Yeah, they're named after their wattage. The X26 is... is higher power, but also light. It's easy to carry.
I guess both of these developments, the fact that the weapons are smaller now and the fact that they were less than effective, according to, I guess, some people in law enforcement who tried them earlier, one could say that what the company is doing, and I'm sure their argument would be that they're responding to the concerns of law enforcement and building them something that they want.
Oh, I'm guessing that that is true. I should say, you know, at the outset that Taser, I tried many, many times to talk to Taser International, and the company did ask me to submit a list of questions by email, which I did, but they didn't talk to me. So I'm getting what I know from news reports, from the company advertising, and they have a very extensive website, and from discussions with law enforcement. But I would say, yeah, probably they certainly responded to a perceived need, and these devices are very popular among law enforcement, and in some cases for good reason.
Now, there, along with the increased wattage, have come some new safety concerns. The company, once again, although I realize you haven't spoken with them, you're probably well aware of their claim that their weapons haven't been responsible for any deaths.
Right.
It would appear that that might not be the case. I'm aware, as you wrote about it in your article as well, of the Amnesty International report, the most recent one, I think, said that 101, I think, was the number in their most recent a report of people in Canada and the United States who have died following being shocked with a taser. So that would seem to lay waste to the company's claims about safety.
Well, I don't think it necessarily lays waste to those claims. What it does is bring them to question. I mean, if people die after use of a taser, there can be many reasons for it. Some of the people were on cocaine, as the company points out. Some of the people were restrained physically. And some of the people, may have had pre-existing conditions. It's really difficult to wade through some of that. Now, there are coroners, there are a number of coroners who have listed the taser as a contributing factor. And in those cases, I think you do have to wonder about those companies' claims. Interestingly, after I wrote this article, I did an updated version of it for Prison Legal News, and I was contacted by someone who wrote an article for Covert Action Quarterly that's appearing there now, and she claims that the taser is that a lot of the deaths associated with tasers are caused by people basically being restrained to death, they suffer breathing problems. On the other hand, there are some serious questions about electricity and the heart in particular, and also about other things, especially when muscles contract violently. And for good reason, Amnesty International has called for tests that are done not by people associated with the company in the history of electronic shock technology, including the stun belt and the stun guns and stun shields, is really full of tests done by company people. But they're asking for independent and rigorous inquiry into the safety of these devices. The Department of Justice here in the United States is actually sent out requests for people to submit proposals for tests, and some of those are being done at Wake Forest College, and some here. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. Some are being done here at the university by a team of scientists. And so these are some, they're actually starting to do those tests. But the truth is, we don't really know what is going on. When I talk to the people here at the University of Wisconsin, they're going to be doing extensive tests on pigs, as you may know. The heart system in a pig is very similar to the human heart. But they're going to be doing shocking pigs that are different sizes. shucking pigs that are on different substances, potentially. And one of the theories, you know, that I talked to all three of the researchers, and some of them think that the taser really does appear to be safe for the heart. But they're wondering about whether when muscles can constrict violently, that tends to dump potassium into the blood, something that also happens with cocaine use, potentially. And potassium can stop the heart, as they point out. So they're wondering about that potential problem. So there really are just a lot of questions. And the point of my article was actually to point out that given the enormous popularity of these devices, they're used in 6,000 law enforcement departments here in the United States. They've been used in what I guess I would call unconventional situations, where on elderly people, on children, on people who are already restrained, on people who seem to be undergoing epileptic seizures or diabetic shock, people in mental hospitals, those kinds of things. And my point was partly to suggest that there may be other concerns given the variability in different bodies.
As far as the restrictions in the use of the weapon that's advised by Taser, though, do they say in their safety literature whether or not people who are elderly or extremely young or who are on certain drugs, both legal and illegal, or who have heart conditions, does the training literature that's offered by the company address any of those issues?
Well, as far as I know, one of the ones that is addressed is the company suggesting that it's, quote, not advisable to use the high power devices on people who are elderly or pregnant. And they actually have a medical study on their website that suggests that elderly people may be more prone to have cardiac problems as a result of being exposed to large quantities of electricity. But as far as children go, the company has claimed to different reporters that it's safe to use them on toddlers, and has said that they've been used on children as young as 1 year old. This year, there have been numerous news reports here of use on both elderly people up to age 75 here in the United States. And I got a letter from a Canadian who claimed that there was someone in his 80s who was shocked in Canada. I'm not sure whether that was true or not, but and children from 12 and under, there's several children.
I actually recall there was a guy who was 78 years old in Victoria, British Columbia.
Okay, that's probably what it is. Yeah. Children, a 6-year-old girl who was restrained in the back of a police car, but started kicking and banging her head. And a 6-year-old boy with a piece of glass who was trying to cut himself. The company claims it's safe to use on children, and one of the things that I should say about the elderly people is that even if that information is in the manuals, when you talk to police departments, they say that they believe it's safe. And I think, you know, the truth of the matter that there's some question about tasers, that it's not clear how safe they are for all bodies. That information, that more complicated information, really hasn't gotten through to some police departments. And they are now, though, because of the publicity around, especially in cities where there's been a shocking of an elderly person, such as Portland, where a blind woman was shocked. She was 71 years old and won a large settlement from the city of Portland. The city is reviewing its policy, and it seems to be happening city by city that, for instance, Miami, where the 6-year-old was shocked and also a 12-year-old who was running from police was shocked, a 12-year-old girl, that city has now revised its use policy to suggest that they shouldn't be used on young children, if at all possible.
But then, on the other hand, they're more frequently being deployed by police officers who are in both elementary and high schools across the U.S.
That's true. What I'm saying is that when something negative happens, especially something that's publicity generating, then the city looks at its policy. But nationwide here, the company claims that 32% of schools are using the devices, and they're even being carried in elementary schools. Sometimes there are officers who are instilled in the schools, and some of those officers carry them at all times. There are two sides to this coin, just as there are with all taser stories, in that, people do say, and the company says, well, what else would they do? But there are major questions when you're using them on kids. The city of Birmingham is bringing tasers in and into, I believe, all its high schools and a number of junior highs, and the officers who do go to elementary schools will also carry them. And there's a big controversy going on there. When I talked to the school superintendent, he said, we need to have a weapon that the children fear. And he also said, we need to control these schools by any means possible. But if you talk to other people around Birmingham, they will say, as a member of the school board said to me, this is, if we're treating the children like criminals, this is a human problem. And that was one of the things that has interested me about this increasing use of tasers in hospitals, etc., that we're starting to use these devices in situations that were, say, quote, civilian, where we might have used other methods, and now they're being defined more and more as situations where you use a weapon.
I wanted to, before I let you go, also address one other thing, and that is the new consumer models of Taser.
Well, it's in the company's interest to get them in as many hands as possible. I mean, I do believe that some of these restraint or these less lethal weapons had a humanitarian element in their development, but they quickly become a money making a means of making money, and that's certainly true when you're starting to get them into consumers' hands. The marketing of these devices has led to kind of a strange scenario in which the company designed the consumer models with a 15-foot range at the most, and then gave the police up to a 21-foot range, so that if there were a duel between a consumer and a police officer, you hope anyway that the police officer would win, at least, or the police will hope anyway. But then in Arizona is the home state of Taser International. The House Speaker decided to propose a bill that would allow police and citizens to use lethal force if they were threatened with a remote electronic device such as a taser. So it's kind of...
That's pretty disturbing.
It has the potential to really escalate use of force in a confrontation, but it's kind of... I think it's one of these situations where this device, and it's true of the police too, where it's the hot new thing, it's the thing to have, and so it's proliferating. But I think we're also seeing, I mean, taser stock has fallen. They're being investigated by the SEC, by the Arizona Attorney General, and certainly criticized by Amnesty International and by a number of reporters now. And some police departments are now really starting to limit their use of the devices. So it may be in a sort of back down period.
Robert Bagnell died after he was shocked with the taser in 2004. We spoke with his sister, Patty Gilman, around 1 year later. In this interview, Gilman tells us about how she became outspoken against tasers in Canada and about the circumstances of her brother's death.
On the 25th of June, my parents got a telephone call. They live in Prince Edward Island, and they had a telephone call from the Vancouver police to advise them that my brother had died, And they led my mother, who spoke with them initially, they led her to believe that he died of a heart attack due to cocaine overdose. And that was sort of the cause of death that we were given at that time. And on the 23rd of July, exactly a month, they told us on the 25th of June that he had died on the 23rd of June. So exactly a month later, on the 23rd of July, the Vancouver police held a news conference to advise the public that they had used a taser on my brother. It took them a month to disclose that information.
Were you aware of that before that time?
No, we were not. No, I got an email from a friend who said that he had seen something on the news and that I should probably watch the news. So we watched it with the rest of Canada on CBC News.
And what was your reaction to learning that your brother had been shot with a taser?
We had no idea what a taser was until then, and we've sure learned a lot since then. We were horrified. It was an awful, awful thing to find out, and especially to find it out in that way. Not to have been told by the police personally, you know, beforehand that they were going to announce this. It was devastating.
Do you know how long the Vancouver police had been using tasers prior to that?
How long they had been using them prior to that, I'm not exactly sure. I do know that the Victoria Police Department was the first in Canada to deploy tasers. But I'm not sure how long Vancouver was using them. And, so 3 weeks after that, after the first news conference, they held a second news conference to suddenly advised that at the time of the incident, there was a fire in the Continental Hotel where my brother lived. And they said that the fire made the use of the taser more urgent, and that what had started out as an arrest had actually turned into a rescue operation, and they had to rescue him from this supposedly burning building. And meanwhile, witnesses have told us that the fire was a small electrical one in a first-floor apartment, and that it was quickly extinguished, and 90% of the people that lived there did not evacuate.
Do you know why they chose to use this device? Did they offer an explanation of, like, had your brother done something, or...?
We don't have any details from them yet. All we have is sort of from what witnesses have said. They've said that he was having a seizure, what appeared to be a seizure, and required medical assistance.
Prior to being shocked?
Prior to being shocked, yes. And apparently the person at the hotel front desk called for medical assistance, and the police instead arrived first. And I think, you know, I think that has a lot to do with the address of the building.
It's in the downtown east side, right?
The downtown east side. And I think that's just, you know, the first response is send the police.
When you found out that your brother was shot with a taser and you hadn't heard about tasers up till that point, could you maybe describe a little bit of the learning curve that you went through with these weapons?
Oh, boy. Thank God for the internet. The learning curve was incredible, fast and furious. I say within, you know, a day or a day and a half, we were on top of what a taser was and could easily describe to people how they worked. And, I mean, just a visit to Taser International's website would give tons of information on what a taser is.
So you decided at some point along the line, because I know you made a deputation to the Toronto Police Services Board last week, you decided to become a lot more outspoken about the use of tasers.
Yes.
What was the impetus for that? Was it that you decided you had a responsibility to speak about it because no one else was?
That has basically been what has driven me over the past several months. I mean, it'll be a year in June. Has been the fact that nobody else seems to be talking about it, and nobody else is making any noise in Canada anyway, that from what I can tell, anti-taser. There's a lot of pro-taser stuff going on, and you know, what originally led me to get involved with the Toronto taser issue was reading a quote from Pam McConnell in the Toronto Star saying that she thought that these weapons needed further study, and she was loath to roll them out without there being further study done on the taser.
And lo and behold, several months later, we have approved the use of at least 100 tasers for the Toronto Police Force.
Yeah.
And the studies have yet to be done.
Are
you aware of the rationale behind their choice of making that decision? Or?
I am aware of the rationale of their making, a lot of their rationale. I think that in the wake of the Deputy Chief Coroner of Ontario's conclusions and statements to the board, I believe that led them to expand their taser use in Toronto.
Now, this guy's name is James Cairns, and as you've pointed out, he is the Ontario Deputy Chief Coroner. What is it that he is not seeing that other researchers are starting to see?
Well, I think Dr. Cairns has an opinion, an unshakable opinion, it would seem, that he told me, in fact, on the telephone last week. I called him because I wanted to challenge him on the statements and conclusions that he's made. It is his opinion that if you die of a taser, you die immediately. That theory is being blown out of the water now by people like James Regeri down in the United States, who's saying that some of the effects of tasers may not even show up immediately. But Dr. Cairns has it in his head that, for some reason, that if you die of an electrical shock, you die immediately. Not a minute or an hour or a day later, but immediately.
Is there any science to back that up?
Well, his science, I believe, from what he said, comes from contacts that he has at the hospital for sick children. I believe what he was referring to was cardiac specialists at that hospital that he has consulted with. I simply wanted to ask Dr. Cairns if he had seen the autopsy results from my brother's death in particular. Knowing the autopsy hadn't even been completed in Robert's case, and his family and I haven't even seen any of it yet, I was quite sure that Dr. Cairns hadn't either, but I wanted to be sure of that. And he did confirm that he has not seen any of those autopsy results, nor has he seen any autopsy results of other taser-related deaths outside of Ontario. Somehow he has concluded, based on his opinion that you die immediately, that all 9 taser-related deaths in Canada had nothing to do with tasers, without even seeing the autopsy results. And it seems to me the ministry and the medical officer of health, who gave a deposition to the board, and ex-chief of police Julian Fantino, and most of the police services board members have relied on his expertise in their support of taser use. And that's pretty scary.
What kind of information did you have in your deputation?
What I wrote to them, I basically described my brother's death and reminded them that 9 Canadians have died after being shocked with taser, and told them about how many people have died in North America since 1999. I told them about the fact that several of these individuals had been shocked numerous times, like the man in Toledo who was shocked 9 times,
mm-hmm.
4 times while he was being arrested, and 5 times when he was already in cells.
For next to no reason,
right. He was loitering or something.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, I told them about a judge in Edmonton who recently concluded that a police officer abused use of force and used cruel and unusual treatment when he shocked an inebriated teen, not to subdue him, but to rouse him from the back seat of a car. And I wanted to remind them that these are being used in brutal fashion. And I also wanted to remind them that it would appear that in North America that the tasers are not being used as an alternative to deadly force, but they're being used to subdue petty criminals or petty offenders, not even criminals, but offenders, people who haven't even been arrested with anything, people who are walking away or not immediately obeying instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to tell them about some of the studies that are being done, and that was pretty much it. And I also told them that I thought that Dr. Cairns needed to be challenged in his assumptions as well.
Are you aware of anyone in the local medical or scientific community that's speaking out against these weapons right now?
Just the Amnesty International. Some gentleman from the Amnesty International organization also had a deputation, a letter, as part of the board package.
Are you encouraged by the fact that many police departments across North America are now having second thoughts?
Very much so.
Is it your feeling that they're... I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you don't think that they've gone quite far enough in questioning these things.
I don't think they have, but I'm pleased to report that they've started to. Police departments across North America are tightening their guidelines, and some of them are even backing off taser deployments altogether, citing safety concerns and lack of independent study and research. And, you know, that makes me question also Julian Fantino's statement that Toronto's taser policy mustn't be overly specific. And I strongly disagree with that, and I think that the taser policy, whatever taser policy Toronto comes up with, must be sufficiently specific.
For example, there would be age restrictions and...
Age restrictions, just so specific that it would prevent abuse of the taser and the possible deadly consequences. It has to be specific enough that tasers are only used as an alternative or last resort to deadly force. You know, it's not the taser that I have a problem with. It's the deployment of the taser and how they're used and the lack of policies. And I think, you know, it could be, when used properly, it could be a not bad thing for a police officer to have when he's faced it, you know, with a dangerous situation. I wouldn't call for tasers to be dropped completely from the arsenal, but I think that they have to have very, very strict policies on when and where they're used.
There's the coroner's inquest coming up in Vancouver in your brother's case. Well, what are you hoping the coroner's inquest will accomplish for you?
I'm hoping we'll get some answers.
Mm-hmm.
That is mainly what I'm looking for, and my family is looking for right now, is answers to the questions that we've been holding on to for all these months. We don't even have a cause of death yet in Robert's case, and we have so many questions about what happened that night, and we look forward to getting the answers, and hopefully that forum will be where we get them.
Are you hoping, or do you know, the upcoming coroner's inquest they're having in Ontario at this spring in London is going to take a look at the issue of tasers in general, in addition to the specific taser-related death that they're looking at? Is that the case in the Vancouver inquest as well?
Well, actually, as a matter of fact, it is. After my brother died, the Police Complaints Commissioner in British Columbia ordered a two-pronged investigation, really, into, one, taser use in general in British Columbia, and two, an in-depth investigation into my brother's death and how he died and what happened, you know, that night. I think, you know, there's so many studies and groups and reviews going on, you know, with regard to the taser right now, that my God, it would be nice if everybody got together and did it in one place. You know, there's got to be 50 studies going on by different people, and they're all going to come up with different answers and different conclusions, and it just boggles my mind that they can't somebody can't take charge and say, let's get together here and do this for all of North America.
It has been 1 year since we originally broadcast that interview with Patty Gilman. A date for an inquest into the death of her brother Robert Bagnell has still not been announced. James Ruggieri is a taser researcher whose work came to our attention through a series of articles in the Arizona Republic. Ruggieri is an engineer whose work has mainly been concerned with electrical safety standards. We spoke to Ruggieri after he gave a talk to a group of forensic scientists in an attempt to point out some of the overlooked and misunderstood effects of tasers.
The science is based on medical research. There were two separate researchers in published medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals, that came up with those findings with respect to the delayed onset of ventricular fibrillation. It was related to low voltage, when I say low voltage, meaning generally voltage under 600 volts. In these particular cases that the researchers evaluated, there happened to have been line current, residential line of voltage of about 120 volts. And what they found in one researcher's case is that they had he had three individuals who presented symptoms following low voltage shock across the thoracic region that culminated, delayed in ventricular fibrillation. In one case, it was up to 12 hours following exposure of an individual to electric shock.
To put it into layman's terms, you're talking about a heart attack.
Well, it's the precursor to a heart attack. What happens in ventricular fibrillation is the two lower quadrants of the heart. The heart is basically a bag segregated into four compartments. The two lower compartments are your ventricles, and those are the sections of the heart that are the business end. They actually do the pumping. They're the pumping generators, if you will, that pushes blood into the body.
Okay.
So when you have ventricular fibrillation, what's happening is that the two lower quadrants are quivering. They're not syncopated with the top two, which are the atrium quadrants that supply blood to the ventricles. Blood doesn't flow. You have inadequate perfusion of the human tissue because the ventricles are quivering. They're not cooperating with each other. It's sort of like milking a cow. You have to guide the blood from one segment to the next. When the ventricles are fibrillating or shaking uncooperatively, what happens is that blood doesn't pump not only to the human tissue, the arms, the head, but to the heart itself. So the heart is starved for oxygenated blood, and that generally manifests in what's known as a heart attack.
Now, when the ventricles are functioning properly, there is some kind of electrical impulse. Is that correct, or am I way off base?
No, yeah, that's correct. Generally, there's an electrical impulse provided generally by the brain, which travels across the heart in such a fashion that the four quadrants are stimulated cooperatively, such that the blood moves from one section of the heart to the next, and then to the next.
So you mentioned that the research that was done earlier was done on a normal household current, which is 120 volts, less than 600 volts, you said.
Yes.
Tasers shock people with 50,000 volts. And my understanding is that there are a number of different, that there's another variable at work here. Because 50,000 volts, people hear that, and it's quite alarming.
Yes, 50,000 or 50 kilovolts is quite a large voltage. Generally, one doesn't see those type of voltage aside from perhaps static electricity or lightning. Typically, it's transmission voltage. Of course, transmission voltages can go well in excess of that, but 50,000 volts is not something that the average individual will see day to day. That's quite a bit of voltage.
Does it compare to a cattle prod or an electric fence or any of the existing presumably safe devices that are on the market? Or?
Well, generally, the cattle prods are less voltage. 50,000 volts, as provided by the taser, sits on the high end of the scale for electroshock devices. Cattle prods, depending on the units that are available, it does vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. Typically, they can range from 2,000 volts to perhaps 10,000 volts. It's rare that you see anything beyond 15,000 volts.
Why do they feel it necessary to use 50,000 volts in a taser?
Well, I suspect that taser's rationale for the high voltage is to overcome the impedance of clothing. Generally, when you're dealing with a cattle or an animal, they do have fur, but they don't have the type of clothing that one might see, particularly in the winter climates, of coats and perhaps vests, shirts, T-shirts. Those are relatively insulating materials. And when asked about the need for the high voltage, Taser has always proffered the intention of the need to break down the insulating barrier provided by clothing. Certainly one would need a lot less voltage to do what the taser does if the assumption is that the individual's without clothing, if they're naked, perhaps.
Right. So in this equation, the probes, the darts that are attached to the taser presumably would not need to be deployed. Because my thinking has always been that they get you through the clothes by, piercing them with those barbed darts.
Well, that's true. But depending on the thickness of clothing, the barbed darts, they do resemble miniature harpoons, and they've been likened to straightened fish hooks. Depending on the thickness of the clothing will determine how much of those darts will bury into the skin, into the human tissue.
Now, Taser International, the company that's taken exception to this one claim, at least, of yours, is calling your claim, I believe the exact word was ludicrous, that I read in the Arizona Republic.
Well, they did identify one of my claims as ludicrous. It wasn't the delayed onset of ventricular fibrillation. There were four items that were presented during my paper. I think the ludicrous claim was related to the issue of standards, which standards applied. In my paper or the presentation identified that Taser misapplied the provisions of UL 69 or Underwriters Laboratory. It's a third-party testing institution here in the United States, mm-hmm. Not too dissimilar to CSA in your country,
right.
The Canadian Standards Association, which performs third-party testing, but UL promulgates standards that are used primarily in the area of electrical safety. I identified that the basis of Taser's claims with respect to that UL standard were faulty. Of course, Taser came out, as you just indicated, and stated that my finding was ludicrous, but in the March 5th Arizona Republic, I think that that issue was put to bed with UL stating that Taser misapplied the UL standard, and what was interesting is that they were told repeatedly prior, at least a month prior to the presentation of the paper by UL, that they were misapplying the standard, yet they continued to use that standard and that basis.
There are other problems with tasers and the science behind their testing in particular. One thing that I came across in your presentation that I thought bore some explanation was whether nerves and muscles were affected by the charge delivered from the taser. Now, my understanding is that Taser International says no.
Well, this is the issue with respect to skin effect.
Okay.
Skin effect is an electrical phenomenon that says that as frequency increases in a conductor, that the current or the charge current carriers tend to push to the outer surface. One of the claims by the medical director of Taser, Dr. Strapbucker, when asked about the Taser current penetrating deep into the tissue, such as to harm the fetus, stated that skin effect would prevent the current from penetrating deep into human tissue. My findings are that we don't have the requisite frequency with the Taser device necessary to invoke skin effect phenomenon. Therefore, and in fact, it's two or three orders of magnitude below what would be required in biological material. Generally, to see skin effect in biological material, one would need about 10 million cycles, or in excess of 10 million cycles. The highest frequency present with the Taser, particularly with the M26, is approximately 50 kilocycles. So that was one of the first engineering errors I uncovered early on in my research with respect to safety claims and the engineering basis for the Taser.
Could you explain a little more about what this skin effect is?
Skin effect is an electrical phenomenon that states that as frequency increases, the charge carriers through a conductor tend to push towards the surface of the conductor. I think I provided you with the presentation.
Yes.
Which provides somewhat of a graphic of that, where the current density is shown around the outer periphery of a conductor. With respect to the Taser device, the claim by Strapbucker is as the frequency is so high that the skin effect occurs and current tends to flow in the outer surfaces of the human body, namely in the skin. That's a fallacy. I don't know if that helps you with the definition. It's easily shown in the mathematics, but I know it doesn't help you here.
Okay. Well, I'll defer to your expertise in that case.
Okay.
I noticed also in the presentation the word pulse comes up in a way which is confusing to me. Could you explain the frequency of the pulse? Is this the 10 million cycles you were referring to earlier, or no?
Well, 10 million cycles is what's required to produce any skin effect phenomenon in human tissue.
Right.
The pulse width of the Taser is approximately 10 microseconds, which equates roughly to about 50 kilohertz. When we're speaking about pulse width or pulses with the Taser, what we're referring to is the time on of the current versus time off. So it's in engineering terms, we're looking at a steep wavefront pulse that comes up to voltage very, very quickly. It's a very abrupt change from zero. It comes up very quickly, unlike a household current, which is graduated, is a linear a smooth linear relation, generally known as a sinusoidal waveform. Mm-hmm. But this is the one can treat this pulse width as a frequency component with the TASER device.
Okay. Now, the frequency. What relevance does this have then with the weapon compared to? I believe that you compared it to an electric fence in your presentation.
Well, the electric fence analogy came out of the earlier studies, approximately 1976, with the Consumer Product Safety Commission. At that time, they had no other basis. There was very little literature with respect to the effects of steep wavefront pulses on humans. The only item or the only literature they had to go on was application of cattle fences. These are fences used to keep livestock away from the from escaping. Basically, it's a wire fence, and electric current is provided pulses on this fence such that if a cattle or a sheep come into contact with the fence, they're jolted back and therefore discouraged from trying that again. This was the early testing by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, I believe it was Dr. Theodore Bernstein, that evaluated the earlier TASER model. This was the TASER Public Defender. It was a 7-watt model in contrast to the 26-watt model output of the M26 present TASER device. And they found that the TASER device, pulsating at 13 pulses per second, was approximately 13 times stronger than the earlier TASER model. So I identified the electric fence simply because the nature of the graph provided by TASER used or attempted to use some of the information from this early document regarding cattle fences. In reality, the analogy is lost, and the device is far, far stronger, particularly the new M26 or the newer M26 TASER model with respect to cattle fences. It's a very poor testing contrast used by the TASER company.
I understand that many coroners, including the deputy chief coroner here in the province of Ontario, is reluctant to say that tasers are responsible for any deaths because of a widely held belief that an electrical shock kills you immediately and is not capable of killing you at a later time. First of all, do I have that straight?
That's you have that straight. That's correct. That is a in some circles that has been a widely held belief. However, my research in uncovering those two particular papers, research papers, shows that's not the case. That we can have delayed death or delayed ventricular fibrillation many hours following exposure to electric shock or following exposure to a taser. The coroners, I believe that they found that to be the most compelling element of my presentation, in which case, from what I understand, many coroners now are reevaluating their protocol in determining death due to electric shock, in which case it may result in reevaluation of previous determinations where the taser was precluded based on that fallacy. Hopefully that'll come to pass.
Are you aware of this case this week in Pacifica, California, where a taser was ruled a contributing factor to the cause of death of an individual who was killed there in January?
Yes, I read about that today, that it was just released today, the coroner's findings that did determine. That case is a good example because the individual was tased, and there was some time lag from the time that he was tased to when he was non-responsive. That would be a good application, although we can take that many hours after tasing.
Has there been any research done on the effect of the length of time somebody is shot with a taser? Now, the reason I ask this is because in the literature I've seen from Taser International, it seems as though they are insisting that people are shocked for a duration of 5 seconds or less, and that's their safety guideline. However, it appears that it is possible to use a taser for a substantially longer period of time. I'm thinking of a case in Indiana a few weeks ago where a teenager was shocked, I believe, 14 times within a 12-minute period, sometimes for a duration of 14 seconds, according to the data kept by Taser's cartridge.
Right, the black box one is able to download. That's a good question. The longer duration one is exposed to Taser pulses, the greater the likelihood of suffering some heart problems, of ventricular fibrillation. One of the research findings that another element that came out during my presentation was offered was the research findings that subsequent pulses serve to reduce the ventricular fibrillation threshold. In the case of steep wavefront pulses, the research shows that following 6 pulses, the ventricular fibrillation threshold drops by a factor of 30. Now, given the taser is a weapon that cycles at a rate of 19 cycles per second, for the minimum 5-second duration where the suspect or patient is exposed to approximately 95 cycles, that is far in excess of the 6 pulses used emanating from my research.
I guess what I'm concerned about overall in terms of the big picture is, how are they getting away with this? It seems to me that they're building these weapons that clearly, at least anecdotally, if not scientifically, are linked to a certain number of deaths. And they're making claims as outrageous as tasers are not responsible for any deaths.
Well, you know, they say they're getting away with it. Therein lies, I don't know how immune they are from this issue. Over here in the United States, there's approximately 20 to 25 class action lawsuits filed against the Taser company. One element in each of those 25 deals with this issue of misrepresentation of product. There's probably about another 20 product liability, wrongful death, or product defect lawsuits, plaintiff actions against Taser, where folks have been hurt, and again, all containing the element of misrepresentation of product. You have to realize that the Taser, as marketed by the manufacturer, is very desirable. The concept is very desirable to police officers because it's something that they can restrain an individual at arm's length. The concept itself does make it safer for the police officers, and it's something that the police officers prefer. Certainly one doesn't want to engage with a irrational suspect, particularly if the suspect is much larger, if they can avoid that. But they've been sold a bill of goods. They've been led to believe that the Taser is so safe that here in the United States, there's been many instances where folks have been tased that normally wouldn't suffer any type of physical force or the minimal amount of physical force, for instance, 6-year-olds or the very elderly. So I think the chickens have come home to roost lately, particularly since the presentation I provided on February 25th. It seemed to have gotten a lot of attention and has perked up a lot of ears. So I think the police jurisdictions are looking with a jaundiced eye towards Taser and now starting to question the veracity of the information provided by them.
One other question I had for you is, and it also came up in your presentation, was that at a range of 21 feet, these barbs that shoot out of the tasers have a propensity to not reach their target, or I forget the language you used in your presentation, but there's a 2-foot margin of error at the 20-foot range, right?
Yeah, generally, as one is as you increase the distance between the taser unit and the suspect, the spread between the barbs increases. At 21 feet, the spread between the barbs is approximately 2 feet. So, ostensibly, if the first barb or one barb flies straight and hits the individual in the region, let's say at the base of the neck, you can expect the other barb to hit somewhere around the lower abdomen, around the belly button region, coinciding with the 2-foot spread. That's problematic in the sense that you're not always going to place the barbs on the suspect where you want, and the accuracy is not all that great. It's a pneumatic weapon. It's not a rifled projectile, and you generally point in roughly in the area you want to hit, the center of mass. But you really don't have any control where those barbs go. I mean, it's possible you could hit someone in the eye or in the face or some area other than what one would intend to hit.
I'm guessing with the introduction of the new model this week that says it shoots with a range of 35 feet, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that this is going to be an even bigger problem.
That's a possibility. Again, the accuracy on these devices isn't all that great. But the question becomes, at how far of a distance does a police officer need to place himself from the suspect? Generally, arm's length is acceptable, provided they're not holding a long baseball bat. 10 feet would probably be ideal, and that's presently what's being recommended by the manufacturer, a 7-10-foot distance.
Are you concerned at all about the new civilian model of taser that's been introduced?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have a great deal of concern for this civilian model. Reportedly, what Taser has offered to the civilian community with their new civilian model is the feature that one can stroke the device so it can remain on for 30 seconds, such that the user can hit the suspect, lay the device on the ground, and provide 30 seconds of time to run away. As we identified earlier, with increasing pulses, you increase the likelihood of ventricular fibrillation, and with 30 seconds, something's bound to happen. I think you'll see a great deal of folks, consumer folks, or civilian-related deaths when the taser's deployed. And also there's the issue of abuse. These devices could be used by the criminal element, or by folks that have similarly been led to believe that these devices are safe. You might see them used in schools, spousal abuse issues. I don't see that much of a value for these devices in the civilian community. And the only exception perhaps would be maybe in airplanes, in terms of airplane security. In the event of hijack, certainly you don't want a ballistic weapon to penetrate the pressure bulkhead of a plane. So the taser might be of value in that particular arena. But I don't see Joe homeowner waking up in the middle of the night in response to a disturbance and grabbing his taser in lieu of a shotgun.
You know, these weapons are being used by school security and the police in schools, and in fact, this week, two teenage high school students were shot with a taser. Last week, same thing. And you mentioned children as young as six. Has there been any research into the effects on the hearts of children?
Well, generally, there's been some general research of the effects of electrical shock as a function of body weight. And intuitively, it's as you guess, is that the smaller the individual, the more susceptible they are. Of course, larger folks, all else being equal, are less susceptible to the effects of electrical shock. So the impacts of a taser on a small body, say a six-year-old or a 13-year-old, can have greater risks and greater implications, sure.
Thanks to Anne-Marie Cusick, Patty Gilman, and James Ruggieri for agreeing to be interviewed for this show. That's all for Bad Cop, No Donut this week. Feel free to email your comments and story ideas. The email address for this program is ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to everyone who took the time to write this week. Bad Cop, No Donut is produced at CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto and can be heard in Santa Cruz, California, on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, and in Wausau, Wisconsin, on WNRB 93.3 FM. I'm Ron Anisich. Thanks for listening.